Welcome to the Deep Dive. You know, sometimes you look around at the world and things just feel, well, chaotic, maybe a bit disconnected. Or maybe you're trying to find some solid ground, a deeper meaning, when everything seems so morally complicated. Wondering if ancient wisdom has anything useful to say today.
Yeah, that search for clarity is pretty universal, I think.
Absolutely. So today we're actually taking a journey way back. We're opening up Psalm 14.
A really potent one.
It really is. And look, this isn't just some old history lesson. It's this incredibly compact, powerful look at human nature, at God's perspective. And kind of surprisingly, it speaks right into our lives now.
Directly.
Our mission here then is to unpack what this ancient text says about, well, spiritual apathy, you could call it, and the sort of corruption that follows.
Right.
But then, and this is key, we want to explore how its insights can genuinely encourage us, maybe strengthen our faith in God, and even guide how we live, how we obey right now.
Finding those practical connections.
Exactly.
Yeah.
We think there are some surprising nuggets here, a kind of shortcut to getting informed on a message that's, frankly, timeless.
Definitely.
Okay, so let's open it up. Psalm 14. It kicks off. Wow, it's bold. Right out the gate.
No kidding.
It says, the fool hath said in his heart, there is no God.
That's quite an opening line, isn't it?
It really sets the stage. And, you know, diving deep here means getting what the fool meant back then in that Hebrew context.
Right. It's probably not exactly what we might think first.
Precisely. It's not really about someone making a philosophical argument like a modern atheist might. It's more about a practical denial.
Practical denial.
Okay, what does that look like?
It's someone living their life as if God doesn't matter, as if his authority isn't real. Their actions just ignore him, ignore any kind of divine accountability.
Ah, so it's about their lifestyle, not just their stated beliefs.
Exactly. They live without reference to a higher moral standard. So in that context, a fool isn't just making an intellectual mistake. They're considered morally corrupt because their behavior has no anchor.
Wow. Okay. That's a deep point right there. The root of moral decay being this practical atheism.
Mm-hmm. It's foundational to the psalm's message.
So that's the human side. But then the psalm shifts perspective, doesn't it? It gives us this image of God looking down from heaven.
Mm-hmm.
What's that about? Is God just watching disapprovingly?
Well, it's more than just disapproval. It's depicted as this act of profound concern and discernment. The text says God is looking down to see if there were any that understood and sought him.
So he's searching, looking for someone who gets it.
Kind of, yeah. It implies this divine search, looking for even a sign of spiritual awareness or moral understanding. But the conclusion God reaches is, well, it's stark.
What does he find?
They are all gone aside. They are all together become filthy. There is none that doeth good. No, not one.
Oof. No, not one. That really lands heavily.
It does. And it's not just the psalmist being pessimistic. It's presented as God's own assessment, a divine statement on universal human brokenness, suggesting that left to ourselves, we tend towards, well, chaos and moral drift.
It's a sobering thought, that universal tendency. And it gets more specific, right? The psalm talks about workers of iniquity. What are they actually doing?
Yeah, the description is vivid. It says, they eat up my people as they eat bread and call not upon the Lord.
Eat up my people as they eat bread. What does that mean?
It's this powerful metaphor for active predatory exploitation. It suggests their oppression of others is casual, almost routine, like eating a meal.
Like it's just natural to them without a second thought.
Exactly. Ruthless. They consume others for their own benefit. And critically, they call not upon the Lord. They operate in this like ethical vacuum. No prayer, no sense of divine accountability.
Which leads to this sort of social cannibalism, as you said. It's a harsh image.
Very. And unfortunately, not entirely unfamiliar when we look around today.
True. But then right in the middle of all this darkness, the psalm shifts again, doesn't it? It offers a contrast.
It does, yeah. Suddenly it states, God is in the generation of the righteous.
Okay, so despite everything, God isn't absent.
Not at all. And it adds that for the poor, the vulnerable, the Lord is his refuge. So even when things look universally bleak, there's this pocket of divine presence and protection for those who do seek him.
That's a crucial turn. And the psalmist, David, he doesn't just leave it there with the grim diagnosis.
No, absolutely not. He ends this section with this deep longing, this hope for restoration. He cries out, oh, that the salvation of Israel were come out of Zion.
Zion, that's Jerusalem, right? God's dwelling place.
Correct. Specifically, the Temple Mount, the symbolic place where God's presence resides and from where help is expected. And then he continues, when the Lord bringeth back the captivity of his people, Jacob shall rejoice and Israel shall be glad.
Jacob and Israel meaning the whole people.
Yes, used interchangeably here for the entire nation. It's this profound prayer for God to step in, reverse their fortunes, maybe literal exile, maybe just oppression, and bring back joy and freedom. It's hope rooted in divine action.
A plea for intervention from God's holy place.
Exactly. It sets the stage for where true hope lies, according to the psalmist.
It's amazing how much is packed into just a few verses.
It really is. And from this, we can pull out, I think, three core teachings that just keep resonating.
Okay, let's break those down. What's the first big takeaway?
The first is pretty direct. Spiritual blindness leads to moral decay. We saw it with the fool, right? That practical denial, living as if God doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Well, the psalm argues that when his truth, his standards, get pushed aside for, you know, convenience or what's trendy, injustice just blooms.
We get a direct consequence.
Almost mathematical, yeah. You see it throughout history, ancient and modern. When accountability to something beyond ourselves, a transcendent moral law, is lost, ethical standards tend to erode. Disconnect morality from its source, and it weakens.
It's not just about personal belief. It's about the tangible impact on how we treat each other, on society itself.
Precisely. Which flows right into the second teaching. The universal brokenness of humanity.
That, no, not one part.
Exactly. That line, no one is inherently righteous, not even one, isn't just David being gloomy, it's a theological diagnosis. Later biblical writers, like Paul in Romans, pick it up.
Right.
It suggests that humanity, kind of left to its own devices, without divine help, naturally drifts towards selfishness, maybe exploitation, definitely spiritual indifference.
That's a tough pill to swallow, especially today when we like to think we're inherently good or can fix everything ourselves.
It is challenging, but the psalm presents it as a reality check.
Yeah.
Look at history. Look at current events. When things break down, that self-interest often surfaces very quickly, doesn't it?
Sadly, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we have spiritual blindness leading to decay and this universal brokenness. Sounds pretty bleak so far.
It does paint a stark picture, but crucially, that's not the end of the story. And that's the third core teaching, hope in divine redemption.
The turn towards hope we saw earlier.
Exactly. Despite the harsh assessment, David doesn't give in to despair. He explicitly trusts that God sees the righteous, that he is their refuge, and that God himself will ultimately bring salvation, bring joy. The hope isn't in people suddenly getting better on their own.
No. Where is it then?
It's squarely placed in God's power to step in, to redeem, to restore. That's why he looks to Zion. To God's action. It's a hope founded on God, not us.
That's a critical distinction. Hope isn't wishful thinking. It's trust in God's character and power.
Perfectly put. Even when things look terrible, the promise of divine restoration holds.
Okay, these are powerful ancient insights. But let's bridge the gap. What does this mean for us, you know, living our lives today? This is where it gets really interesting, I think.
I agree. If we connect this to our world, the first application seems unavoidable. Don't ignore the moral consequences of spiritual apathy.
How does that play out today?
Well, it's so easy, isn't it, to live as if God is irrelevant. Maybe not consciously deciding he doesn't exist, but practically.
Yeah, getting caught up in chasing success or comfort, or maybe our own version of personal truth.
Right. And sidelining bigger questions of accountability or compassion or God's standards. We might even say we believe, but our daily choices, our priorities, they might tell a different story.
And Psalm 14 warns that has knock-on effects.
A huge knock-on effect. It warns that ignoring God, practically speaking, often leads to a breakdown. Injustice, in empathy, even in community bonds. When we really get those consequences, not just as ideas, but seeing how they affect our neighborhoods, our world, it can actually motivate us.
Also.
It encourages us towards, well, obedience. Not out of fear, maybe, but out of recognizing that living as if God matters actually contributes to good, to justice, to shalom. Sidelining him has real costs, not just for us spiritually, but for everyone. Understanding that strengthens our resolve to live faithfully.
That's a really practical link between understanding and action, connecting belief to societal well-being. Okay, what's the second application for us?
The second is a vital call to humility and self-examination. Remember that universal none doeth good.
Hard to forget.
Well, the invitation there isn't really to point fingers at everyone else's flaws. It's first and foremost a call to look inward.
Ouch. Okay.
Yeah. It prompts us to ask, am I living in line with what's truly good according to God's standard? Or am I just doing what feels right or what's easy or what my immediate circle approves of?
That requires some serious honesty.
It does. And that kind of humility, that self-examination, is actually crucial for strengthening faith. It makes us admit we don't have it all figured out, that we are broken, that we need grace constantly.
And that need, that leads somewhere.
It leads to dependence on God, not ourselves. We stop relying on our own shaky righteousness and lean on His. And paradoxically, that dependence fosters a desire for obedience because we recognize we need His guidance, His strength, His transformation. It frees us from trying to be perfect on our own steam.
So recognizing our weakness actually makes us lean more heavily on God, which fuels our faith and desire to follow Him. That's counterintuitive but powerful.
It really is.
Okay, and the third application.
The third flows right from this. Rest in the hope of restoration.
Back to hope.
Always back to hope. Whether you're looking at huge global problems that seem completely unsolvable, or maybe just wrestling with personal struggles, setbacks, failures, Psalm 14 points us towards hope.
But hope in what specifically? Not in human plans.
Not primarily in human effort alone, no. Hope in God's unwavering power to redeem and restore. It's this bedrock message.
Yeah.
Even in this messy, broken world, God's purposes of justice and joy will prevail.
Like David crying out for salvation from Zion.
Exactly. That wasn't just a wish. It was an active declaration of trust that God will act. And resting in that divine hope, that's maybe the most powerful faith strengthener there is.
How so?
It gives you an anchor. When the world feels like a storm, this hope keeps you steady. It reassures you that God is ultimately in control, that His good purposes win out. And knowing that deep down gives you courage.
Courage to do what?
Courage to live faithfully now, to act obediently even when it's hard, to keep going when things look bleak. Because you're not banking on your own success, you're trusting in His ultimate restoration. It replaces anxiety with a robust faith.
That is a deeply encouraging message, especially for right now. An anchor in the storm.
Precisely.
Okay, let's try and boil this down. The quick takeaway from our deep dive into Psalm 14 might be this. When people live as if God doesn't exist, whether they say it outright or just live that way, things tend to unravel morally. Injustice creeps in.
Right. That practical denial has consequences.
But even then, even with that universal human tendency towards brokenness, there's real solid hope. Why? Because salvation, restoration, it ultimately comes from God. He's the refuge.
That's the core message. Apathy leads to decay, but God offers redemption.
So, Psalm 14, written thousands of years ago, yet it feels incredibly relevant, doesn't it? It speaks to our struggles, our tendencies, and points us towards enduring hope.
Still powerful.
Definitely. So, as you go about your week, here's something to maybe reflect on. How might recognizing the deeper consequences of just drifting along spiritually, the apathy we've talked about, or maybe embracing a moment of real humility about your own journey, how might that help you lean into, rest more fully, more faithfully, in the hope of God's restoration?